The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Authorities are confirming that Prince has died at age 57. Just last week, Prince's plane was forced to make an emergency landing in Illinois due to a medical condition. He had been battling the flu, according to TMZ.com. Prince was an intensely private celebrity, performing on stage and on records, but rarely giving interviews. But here he was in 2004 speaking to Tavis Smiley on why his fans loved him so much.
I never talk down to my audience. And when you don't talk down to your audience, then they can grow with you. I give them a lot of credit to be able to hang with me this long, because I've gone through a lot of changes. But they've allowed me to grow, and thus we can tackle some serious subjects and try to just be better human beings, all of us.
Bouquets of flowers, many of them purple, of course, have begun to appear already outside Prince's Paisley Park estate near Minneapolis. Prince leaves behind a long musical legacy spanning funk, pop, rock, and soul, and also a history as an era-defining artist who was fundamentally uncomfortable with the business of the industry that made him a success. John Schaefer is host of Soundcheck on WNYC. John, welcome.
Thanks.
It's a shame to turn to you at a time like this.
This has been a bad year, you know, David Bowie first and Prince now. And
Merle Haggard. So what have we lost?
Well, what we've lost is a figure whose reach goes beyond just the music. And if it were just the music, that would be enough. But you have to look at Prince as the whole kind of figure in our wider culture. His own ambivalent views about the record industry, the music industry, the digital music industry, copyright, media, all of these things that were part and parcel of the Prince experience, both for him and for those of us who consumed his music, because he was just as interested in how we got his music, the channels through which it came to us, as he was in delivering to us.
And we'll talk about that second part in 1 second, because Prince really entrenched himself in a lot of those debates and helped define them. Let's talk about the music for a moment. People instinctively go back to 1999. They'll go back to Purple Rain, of course, when Prince really started to make his mark on popular culture. Where did it go from there? People will remember the 80s, even if they're too young to remember them. They know about Purple Rain. So
yeah.
Where did it go from there?
Well, you know, you have to remember that when Prince began, he presented this kind of persona very much in a kind of David Bowie way, where there was a kind of gender fluidity, there was a certain racial fluidity. You weren't quite sure what this guy was. Was he a guy? You know, and he played with that in a lot of his songs, early songs like When You Were Mine, which really play around with gender roles and sexuality in a very unconventional way. That kind of set the stage for a lot of what we know about Prince, you know, the better known songs, the Purple Rains and the Little Red Corvettes in the 1999s. Where did it go from there? It kind of elevated Prince to the level where he was this kind of mononymic entity, you know, like Madonna or Bowie, you know, where you just needed the one word and you knew exactly who you were talking about and perhaps even the wider picture of what you were talking about.
So, John Schaefer, let's come back to where we started, because Prince had a tumultuous relationship with music marketing, with the way his music was put out, both on the internet, on record. I mean, in 2007, he famously gave away an album to a newspaper in London, and that was just the start of it.
Well, he had a very fraught relationship with digital media. to the point where when he performed Radiohead's Creep and that appeared on YouTube, he was very quick to insist that that be taken down.
Scrubbed everywhere. I tried to find it myself.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, there he was giving his album away with the mail on Sunday in the UK. So he very much plowed his own field, you know, in the music world. He didn't go the usual route. The whole period of his life where he turned his name into a symbol, the slave tattoo, you know, the idea that being contracted to a record company made him a sort of indentured servant as opposed to a creative artist. He spent much of his career finding ways to be that creative artist and not to be beholden to the usual channels in which those creative artists get to disseminate their work.
Was he capricious, though, in these positions that he took, or was there a theme to it? I mean, giving your album away is one thing. On the other hand, as you said, he was famous for scrubbing certain songs from the internet. Other times he made stuff available on the internet, and it didn't seem like there was an underlying principle here.
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think capricious might be an interesting word to use in this case because it does at first seem like it's just caprice. I think what it is Prince, who was kind of trying to do it all himself, was in microcosm doing what the industry as a whole had been trying to do for the last 20 years, which is figure out how to respond to changing times and to changing media. So he was doing the same thing that the big record companies were doing, which is how do I deal with copyright? How do I deal with intellectual property that I've created? How do I deal with when I borrow from someone else, when I sing someone else's song? I don't think it was caprice so much as a kind of evolving way of dealing with a whole welter, a mix of very thorny, difficult issues.
All right, well, let's end on the music as we're digesting this news of Prince's death at 57. John Schaefer, favorite song, favorite album?
I'm going to go with When You Were Mine, an early song of his that I heard this done as an Elizabethan lute song, and it was brilliant, and it just proved to me what a great song this is.
That's great. John Schaefer, it was less than a year ago that I was in the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. Prince played for 3.5 hours, and during the show we said, who is that guy on the couch on the right-hand side of the stage? And when he stood up and approached the keyboard, Prince went over to the keyboard and played the opening keyboard to Superstition, and Stevie Wonder played 45 minutes.
Nice. An amazing figure and a great loss to the music world.
John Schaefer, host of Soundcheck on WNYC. Prince, dead at 57. Let's continue our conversation now on Prince, dead at 57. Melissa Locker is with me. She's a culture reporter whose work is featured in The Guardian and Time magazine, among other places. Good to have you, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Prince was just out on tour, played as recently as 2 days ago in Atlanta.
I know. I think that's part of the reason people are so shocked about this, because normally when someone who's only 57 passes away, you expect there to have been sort of like a long illness or something. But he was playing in Atlanta on his tour, doing his piano and microphone, very intimate shows. Fans could see him. No one reported that he looked ill. And then a few days ago, there was that emergency landing and he got taken off the plane to the hospital. But I don't think anyone really expected this at all.
So what kind of tour was this? This was a purely musical show. He was playing stripped-down shows. I saw Prince about a year ago in Washington, and it was fairly elaborately staged with different sets and costumes.
Yeah, and I think he wanted to kind of get back to his, I don't know, early days. Or actually, I guess his early days were Purple Rain. So he wanted to do something different. And so he reinvented himself once again. Went on tour with his very stripped-down show. It was just him and a piano and a microphone just doing some of, you know, his songs throughout the year that he'd come up with. And I didn't get to go see the show, but people I know who'd went said it was absolutely amazing, incredible set list, and just a really interesting, unique way to see Prince.
So we spent a little bit of time with John Schaefer talking about Prince's fraught relationship with the music industry and in some ways with music fans. But I want to drill down on the online part with you, because Prince was well known for keeping a lot of his stuff off of the internet entirely, even in some cases preventing paid downloads on some services. It was a very strange relationship.
Right. Like, I was going to say that you're not going to see any, you know, photo, like videos from people's phones from these shows, because he would absolutely refuse to let people take photos of his shows, let people take videos of the shows, and those videos never made it online. If you go on YouTube, and, you know, a lot of the world gets their music from YouTube, and fans might be rushing to YouTube right now trying to find their favorite Prince songs, and they're most likely not going to find them, because Prince and his team were very, very strict about their intellectual property, and they did not let anybody upload videos to YouTube that included their music. Like, I dare you to try and find Bat Dance on YouTube right now. It does not happen.
How did he feel about other streaming services like Spotify, like iTunes, and some of that part of the industry?
He's now available on iTunes, I believe, but he's definitely not on Spotify. I don't think he's on Beats. He may be on Tidal, but he definitely wanted to keep – I think actually he is on Tidal, and that was one of the biggest coups that they were able to announce at the rollout. He just he's just always been really, really strict about who wants to be his music. But don't forget, this is an artist who changed his name to a symbol to trying to get out of his contract with Warner. Like, he really just wanted to be absolutely in control of his music all the time. And, you know, his first album after getting out of the contract was called Emancipation, because he was suddenly free. And I think he never wanted to lose that control again. But unfortunately for fans, sometimes that meant not being able to, you know, go to YouTube and pull up their favorite song and just, you know, rock out to Let's Go Crazy.
Melissa Locker, culture reporter for The Guardian, for Time Magazine, and here on The Takeaway. Thanks for helping us remember Prince.
Anytime.
And we've been hearing from you on Facebook. Stephanie Hartwell Mandela tells us, my brother got us Purple Rain tour tickets for Christmas in 82. All-time best. Everyone in leather, silk, and lace. Me in leather pants, leather boots, and a purple tight cashmere sweater. The whole place dancing and singing along. It was the best ever. This from Johnny Gonzalez. The fact that I can't listen to any of Prince's music on YouTube or Spotify really adds to my respect for him. The art he created belongs to him and him alone, and he did a fantastic job in showcasing his talent for all to experience. Rest in peace, Prince. You will be missed.
This is Tim Carlberg. I'm up in Minneapolis, and it seems like everyone in this town has their own Prince story, and mine is that he made life a little more cheerful at times when little else could. We're going to miss him.
I think my favorite performance of Prince wasn't actually a song he sang necessarily, but one of his electric guitar performances. Not many people realize what an incredible guitar player he was. And his performance specifically of While My Guitar Gently Weeps in 2004, paying tribute to George Harrison, just sends chills up my spine every time I listen to it. He just totally dominated that guitar performance, and I think that's a great way to remember a great music icon.
My Take is our number. We want to hear from you. Of course, you can comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
President Obama and lawmakers and even the presidential candidates have been trying to tackle the issue of crippling student debt in this country. When former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels became president of Purdue University 3 years ago, though, he did something that hasn't been done in 36 consecutive years. He froze tuition for the next 4 years and cut student costs, making that Big Ten school less expensive than it had been 3 years before. But Mitch Daniels is also experimenting with new ways to help students pay for college, and it isn't alone at all. Students at Purdue can pledge to pay a percentage of their future earnings in return for money to pay tuition today. The Daniels and Purdue call the income sharing agreement back a boiler. They're Boilermakers, after all. And it's the first American university to officially embrace the idea.
We've created as one more option on the student's financial menu what is called an income share agreement. And it is not a loan. The student agrees to a contract to pay a specified percentage of their future earnings for a specified number of years, depending on what they're studying and what their likely career is going to be. If the student succeeds and does very, very well, the investor may also. But likewise, if the student's career doesn't work out, then the student is not on the hook, as they are inescapably, even in bankruptcy, from the government loan programs. But we'll see if there's interest. It's novel, and it might not have a lot of uptake.
How much uptake so far? Any?
Well, we just opened the window for examination of, last week, and we've had 3,300 visits to the tool that was built to show a student exactly what the terms in their case would be and how it compares to the private loans that they might otherwise take out.
Governor Daniels, let's take a second and role play a little bit maybe. I'm a student and I go to Purdue. I'm in a career that maybe I know isn't going to pay me a lot, but I really have a passion to be a school teacher. So how would it work for me to do one of these back-a-boiler agreements versus my friend down the hall in the dorm who's a pre-med?
You would likely be asked to pay a higher percentage of your income, and it might be for a slightly longer period. Now, there are caps on the amount of repayment the way we've set it up. There's a 9-year cap, which is shorter than government loans on the term that can be there. But in any case, it'd be purely voluntary. You would fix your exposure. It could be 5 or 6 or 7% of your income. And you would have decided that's an affordable amount. So there'll probably be, at least in the initial stages, some cross-subsidy of, let's say, teachers by electrical engineers. It's not clear exactly what the terms might be. If the number of these agreements grew large enough, the market would start to set those rates.
Well, you know, this sounds strikingly almost like an income tax arrangement. You pay a fixed amount of your income, not for 9 years if you're an American citizen, but in perpetuity. I suppose as a former White House budget director, the logic of this might have made some sense to you.
Yeah, I think the way to think about it is this would be the substitution of equity for debt. That is to say, in this case, the investor takes the risk that it won't work out. In the debt arrangements, the student is stuck regardless whether they graduate, regardless whether they get a job, regardless whether that job pays well or doesn't. And we made a lot of headway here at Purdue, both between holding down the cost and by counseling with students about the debt they take on. We've seen a reduction of some $50 million in outstanding student debt. Perhaps this income share agreement will appeal to some percentage of our juniors and seniors and bring that number down further.
Governor, doesn't all of this point to a major failure in the political system? We've all watched as everyone from President Obama on down has tried to address what's perceived as a crisis in student loan debt. Certainly the candidates, especially on the Democratic side, are running around coming up with various plans to either make college tuition free in the case of Senator Sanders or to help with major debt payments. You don't hear much about it on your side, on the Republican side, but it seems to me that this experiment that you're running and the need for alternatives points to a political failure.
First, careful about the your side. I'm long gone from partisan politics.
Okay.
But I take the point. I really do think that some new thinking's in order. The attempts by various candidates, maybe on both sides, to outpromise each other aren't taking us anywhere. There isn't going to be any free education. It's going to cost an extraordinary amount of money if you ever tried to do what's been suggested. It would further the well-understood phenomenon now in which we flood the marketplace with funds and costs go up. So I don't think those are serious proposals, and we're not proposing or imagining that this idea of ours is a replacement for a new and better thinking, but at least it's new.
Governor Daniels, before I let you go, I have to do a little bit of politics. I'd be remiss if I didn't. The Indiana primary is coming up. I know you're not in partisan politics anymore, but you were an extraordinarily popular governor in the Midwest. Can the Republican Party, if Donald Trump is close, 1,200 delegates or something close to 1,237, can they legitimately deny him the nomination and still remain viable with their base, with their voters? How does that work?
Well, there's two questions there, and I'll speak clinically here. Sure they can. There's never been a nominating process that I'm aware of that didn't require a majority. And somebody who falls short of the majority, it's their job to get over the top, not somebody else's to hand them the nomination.
You were praised for turning around a terrible bond rating in Indiana, replenishing a depleted state budget, a highly respected governor and the model of Republican governors everywhere, like Scott Walker. The Republican Party on a third or fourth ballot, we're all aware of this, may be looking for a savior candidate from the outside who can unify the party. I have to ask, could it be you? Could it be Daniels?
You have to ask, but I don't have to answer. And I think I'll just say I'm completely committed to what I'm doing. I've made a promise to do it, and I will be doing it next year, I'm quite sure.
But that's not a no. I'm sorry, Governor, but that's not a no. It won't be me. That's not Sherman-esque.
Well, it won't be me. I told the folks out here, I said, put me down halfway between the General Sherman and Sergeant Schultz, if you remember the allusion, someone who knew nothing and had heard nothing, and that's my situation, too.
Well, the Republicans may be looking for someone like Mitch Daniels if they can't get Mitch Daniels. Mitch Daniels is president of Purdue University, former governor of Indiana, former White House budget director in the White House of President George W. Bush. Thank you, Governor.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And do you remember the first time they made you read Shakespeare in school? The long speeches, the impenetrable language in 16th century British.
Here is a skull that hath lain you in the earth 23 years.
Whose was it?
A whoresome mad fellow it was.
Why is that guy pacing around talking to a skull? What does the skull represent? I don't know. It's a skull. It's death? I guess? When's lunch? Anyway, maybe you slogged through and memorized the speeches they made you memorize and then, as quickly as you could, forgot them. Or maybe you had one teacher in high school who held the secret keys to Shakespeare, one of the people who got it, the conflict, the fear, the doubt, the politics, somebody who let you in on the R-rated body jokes. If you were one of those people, then you were ready for the moment when Hollywood started to make Shakespeare cool.
For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
Have not saints' lips? And holy palmers too.
I, a pilgrim, lips that they must use in prayer.
Yes, they put Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes in Romeo and Juliet. They made it the teen heartthrob story it was meant to be. Then there was Shakespeare in Love.
Son, it's not my fault, Master Shakespeare. I could do it yesterday.
Do me a speech. Do me a line.
Parting is such sweet sorrow.
Another little problem.
What do we do now?
The show must...
Go on.
Audiences went in droves to see that. They also went to see Hamlet's coolest practitioner, Kenneth Branagh. He put 4 hours of Hamlet on the big screen in a great big way.
To be or not to be.
Now, Hollywood's obsession opened Shakespeare up to a whole new generation of kids, and that's all over now. Hollywood has moved on. But the kids and Shakespeare, they're still going strong. Carly Webster is a senior at James M. Bennett High School on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and she joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Carly, when was the first time, if you remember, that you realized that maybe Shakespeare was more than, you know, a guy pacing around the stage with a skull making boring speeches?
At the beginning of this year with Taming of the Shrew, that definitely made me think a little deeper than I've ever had to with Shakespeare before. It was a little more challenging than the other ones, I personally feel, to understand exactly the character's motives, especially Kate's, you know, because she's such a bizarre character in that time frame. And not only that, but I'm sure even, you know, in today's modern time, she would have been perceived as someone very bizarre and, you know, out of place. And it was definitely hard to grasp exactly what was going on in her head. And there's many different interpretations that you could come up with.
Now, let's talk about who's played Shakespeare. Carly, have you had the chance to act at all or get involved in the theater?
I do plenty of acting. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, none with Shakespeare as of yet, but I have been in the drama club of James M. Bennett ever since I was a freshman. And as of my junior year up until now, I am currently the president of the drama club here.
Oh, president of the drama club means you do plenty of acting, as you said.
Yes.
And still, watching Shakespeare plays has to inform a lot how you think about staging and directing.
Oh, yeah. Being able to use one scene for multiple purposes is very smart. And oftentimes, if it's done well, as Brown Box Theater has always done it, it's very effective, too, and easy to understand exactly what's going on.
Carly, what happened when you told your grandma that you had started to take an interest in Shakespeare and what the Brown Box Theater was doing?
When I told my grandmother, she was ecstatic. she pulled out her, I believe it was a copy of The Comedy of Errors. Judi Dench performed in it, and that was a riot. I loved it, and it really showed me the aspect of Shakespeare that wasn't tragedy, that I hadn't really had experience with up until that point. And, you know, it was really, it's a stretch of the believable that you could see, like something in modern times, but because it's that stretch, it makes it that much better and that much more entertaining because it's not so normal. And something along the lines of comedy like that was really a game changer, and it really it expanded, you know, what I knew about Shakespeare and my interest in it.
When I was in school, we studied a lot of Shakespeare, of course. I had a couple of great teachers that really turned me on to it. And then there was this phenomenon where Shakespeare became really, really popular in pop culture. Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes did Romeo and Juliet. And then from there, just movie after movie, it was one of the best fads that ever came out of Hollywood. Did you guys catch some of those movies and with your friends?
Of course, I've heard about the Leonardo DiCaprio, Romeo and Juliet. I didn't see it. I have seen Romeo and Juliet, a different version. I believe it's a little bit older. That and Comedy of Errors are all I've ever seen on screen, unfortunately.
Carly Webster is a senior at James M. Bennett High School on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Carly, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
Well, it's been 400 years since Shakespeare left this mortal coil, but his work and his influence are as strong as ever. Today, we're paying tribute to the Bard by asking you to share your favorite lines from his plays and favorite movie adaptations of the work. From Grays Lake, Illinois, I like the movie 10 Things I Hate About You. That's supposed to be an adaptation of The Taming of the Shrew. And Concord, California likes Hamlet, talking about his mother, Gertrude. Methinks the lady doth protest too much.
Hi, my name is Amy, and I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. My favorite adaptation of Shakespeare is Shakespeare Behind Bars at Luther Luckett Correctional Facility in LaGrange, Kentucky. Watching these grown men, many who don't have a high school education, memorize and perform Shakespeare verbatim is absolutely amazing.
From Concord, North Carolina, double, toil and trouble, because my four-year-old says it, bubble, toil and twubble.
Hi, this is Sue from Hillsborough, New Jersey. My favorite quote is from Shakespeare's Richard II. This happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England.
And from Millbrook, Alabama, more Hamlet. Though this be madness, yet there is method in it. 8778 My Take is our number. You can comment at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Welcome back. Todd Zwillick with you today. Queen Elizabeth II turns 90 years old today, and her son, Prince Charles, paid tribute to her with a reading from Shakespeare's Henry VIII.
She shall be, to the happiness of England, an aged princess. Many days shall see her, and yet no day without a deed to crown it.
Now, for most of her long reign, the Queen has ruled, well, symbolically over the British Commonwealth. It's mostly ceremonial these days. But that wasn't always the case. Kings and queens used to rule the British Empire, and it was far from symbolic. Today, you can find vestiges of empire in England and all over the world, and sometimes controversy to go with it. This week, India politely asked Britain to return the Koh-i-Noor diamond. It's one of the oldest and well-known jewels in the world. The 105-carat gemstone passed through the hands of Mughal and Persian and Afghan rulers until the British took it in 1849 by force, apparently. Today, it's in the Tower of London, where tourists come to see it by the millions attached to the crown jewels. Now, there have been demands for the jewel to be returned since India gained independence, but the response from Britain, well, unwavering. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron on Indian television in 2010.
The Koh-i-Noor diamond, are you ever going to return that?
That is a question I've never been asked before.
Well,
but I don't think what tends to happen with these questions is if you say yes to one, you suddenly find the British Museum would be emptied.
Well, that's fine for David Cameron, but for many Indians, the Koh-i-Noor diamond is a painful reminder of colonialism and of a national artifact taken by force. Joining me now from London is Anita Anand. She's a broadcaster and co-author of a forthcoming book on the Koh-i-Noor diamond. Anita, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Todd.
Well, there is a long and twisted history, as I said. How exactly did the British get their hands on it in the first place?
It's a story of friendship turned sour, or perhaps surreptitious muscle flexing in the shape of friendship. So let me take you back. There was a man called Ranjit Singh, the Lion of Punjab, he was called. I mean, if you watch Game of Thrones, you hear reference to the King of the North. He was the real deal. He had united a disparate north of India into this almighty Sikh kingdom. But when he died and the throne passed to his son, a little boy, at the age of five who came to the throne, things changed drastically. The British, who'd never been able to get a foothold in the north as long as the Lion was alive, suddenly saw a chance to inveigle their way in. So first they come as friends, they sign treaties of friendship, they then start building up troops around the border, they are agitating within the boy king's court. So by the time that he's eight, all hell is breaking loose in his kingdom. They've done deals with really significant members of his court, his general, his vizier, and they are telling these men that, look, when the time is right, you betray the king, and we will give you something for your troubles. In fact, what they were offering were little kingdoms in their own right. So war is fought. They start getting a foothold. They can't get rid of the Maharaja because this is such a strong kingdom that these are warrior men in the north. So they say, no, we're leaving your Maharaja as he is, but just, you know, we come as friends. We're going to be in Lahore and we're just going to help him out a bit. And slowly but surely, they remove anybody from the Maharaja who can advise him. They take his mother, who is his greatest support, screaming from his side, and they lock her in a tower. And so in the end, you just have this really rather terrified little boy who is told that, look, if you want us to guarantee your safety, you're going to have to sign over the kingdom to us. And that's what he does. He's 10 years old. He's surrounded by grown men who are telling him, you sign here. And that's exactly what he does. He signs over his kingdom, he signs over his future, and he signs over this extraordinary diamond, the size and heft of a hen's egg, the most precious jewel in the world.
And so in a way, this diamond, though it's precious, is really just a symbol of an entire kingdom that these British invaders took for their own.
It was such a potent symbol of power that it was the one thing that Duleep Singh, this boy king who later grows to become consumed by the loss of it. It is the thing that he regrets the most. And, you know, the Indians didn't always have it. Ranjit Singh himself got the gem from a man called Shah Shuja. And you can trace it. I mean, I'm co-authoring this book, and it's a really kind of neat way of doing it, because the latter part of its history is my expertise, and the former part is a man called William Dalrymple, who has studied ancient Persian texts and goes right back to the Mughal period. So this is your original blood diamond, if you like. People have fought and died to get their hands on it. And I'll tell you for why. It's not just because of its symbolism, it was also because of its value. I mean, let's just put the bucks on the table. How much was it worth? Well, one of the sayings from a woman called Wafa Begum, who was the consort of one of the kings who had it previously, said, if you were to throw a rock high into the air, as high as you can, and to the left and to the right, all the space contained within. If you were to fill it with all the jewels and diamonds in the world, that would be the value of the Kohinoor. It represented wealth, it represented power, but it also represented India in many ways.
So let's talk about the time since 1850. Have there been concerted efforts from India, especially since independence in 1949, to get the Kohinoor back?
There have been efforts not only from India. I mean, there was a petition actually from a man who was serving as Indian High Commissioner in London at the time, who made active approaches to the British government saying, you know, you really need to give this back because it was taken illegally. There are representations that have been made from Pakistan. There's one that currently a petition has been accepted in the Pakistani courts saying this was a jewel of Lahore. Lahore now lies in Pakistan. You give it back to us. The Iranians would like it back. I think in the year 2000, the Taliban said they wanted it back because it was an Afghan gem. Yes, between you and me and the enormous takeaway audience, I've had people coming to me since I've written a book about the Duleep Singh family saying, you know, we are actually illegitimate children of his children. So maybe we have claims to this diamond as well.
There is a long list of foreign treasures in England, I'm sorry to say, that Britain has had to justify keeping. All products of empire, the Elgin marbles from the Parthenon, countless Egyptian antiquities from Giza and the Valley of the Kings and Karnak in Egypt, and now the Kohinoor diamond, and that only scratches the surface. Does there come a point where it's hard to justify keeping all of these things in London when the empire is gone?
You know, you have that brilliant satirist that we've lent to you. We'd like him back at some point, John Oliver, who said that, you know, the British Museum is now officially a crime scene. you make a very good point. These are the spoils of empire, no doubt about it.
Anita Anand is co-author of the forthcoming book on the Kohinoor Diamond. And here's something to take with you today. Of course, Queen Elizabeth's royal personage is all over the coins and bills of the Commonwealth. She's on Canadian and Jamaican, even Australian money. Here in the U.S., finally, a woman is set to appear on the $20 bill, and we've been hearing from you.
This is Christina calling from Taunton, Massachusetts. I'd just like to say that Harriet Tubman is a far better choice than Andrew Jackson for the $20 bill. I never expected to actually see a woman on our currency, so this is completely wonderful.
Of course, the original plan was to take Alexander Hamilton off of the 10, but Hamilton is popular. He's got a mega hit musical all about his life, and a lot of people complained. Treasury responded, and instead they went after Andrew Jackson, who, of course, is extremely unpopular these days thanks to his slaveholding and genocidal ways. Andrew Jackson's going to move on to the back of the 20 while Harriet Tubman is on the front. Women and civil rights leaders will also be added to the backs of the $5 and $10 notes, according to the Treasury. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. You can comment at thetakeaway.org. We always want to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering tools for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom frame prints and posters. Designed and printed in-store or ordered online at staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI. Public Radio International.